The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 265.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is my good buddy. And, you know, I was in the shower this morning, Jeff, trying to think of some way to intro you like Emil does.
Yeah.
Like the rad guy of Repo or something. I just couldn't think of it. You know, he's just really got a talent there. He's so much more articulate than I am. So, unfortunately, viewers, here he is, Jeff Snyder.
Yes. I mean, I don't know what Emil's secret is. I don't know if he spends a lot of time coming up with these things or practices them himself or whatever, but he does have a talent. It's very awkward to say he has got a talent for introducing me, but you know, he's a creative guy and he's got a lot more talents than that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, he is one of the most creative, you know, with the intros, not only your intro, but the intro to the show. And he's just an amazing, amazing host. The show that you guys do, Making Sense, we'll give it a plug, is just absolutely fantastic. And it's a must watch or listen on YouTube, or I think it's on all the podcasting platforms, isn't it?
Yeah. And if it was just me, nobody would ever, you would shut it off after 10 seconds. So it's really down to Emil's creativity and personality, and you know, he's an entertaining, engaging kind of guy.
Yeah, he is. He really is.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we get into reverse repo and some of the things I wanted to discuss, I've been trying to think through a couple things, and I was going to go do a bunch of research, and I'm like, oh, shoot, I'll just ask Jeff because he'll know the answer right away. So I was trying to think about banks that don't have reserve accounts with the Fed. So like a credit union or maybe a bank outside of the United States, say in the Cayman Islands or something like that. And so if I'm transferring a money or let's call it dollar liabilities of a commercial bank like Wells Fargo, and that Wells Fargo, I'm transferring $1,000, let's say, to the credit union. So Wells Fargo, if I understand it correctly, is going to transfer that credit union $1,000 liability. Which would be my $1,000 asset, but then they've got to transfer them an asset to match up with that liability. So what is the asset that's being transferred there if the credit union doesn't have a reserve account with the Fed?
Oh, it could just be some form of depository cash or equivalent. And that's really why they call cash and cash equivalents. Because
so they literally could send them $1,000 of green pieces of paper.
Yes, absolutely. And that's really, I mean, before we were told to focus on the Federal Reserve and bank reserve because there wasn't any bank reserves, that's how everything got done. Everything was settled in bank money. And, you know, it gets a little more interesting when you get outside the United States and transfers of U.S. dollars and euro dollars between banks completely outside the U.S., but it gets done the same way. I mean, there's any number of interbank methodologies to do it. You know, you could use chips rather than Fedwire, for example. So there's any number of ways and infrastructure to settle claims that doesn't involve bank reserves in the Federal Reserve.
So their balance sheet matches up. Their liabilities match up with their assets.
Right. And there's all sorts of systems in place to make sure that if I say I claim $1,000 from you, you agree with me. Or if you don't agree with me, we can settle. I mean, there are interbank processes to make sure that all these trillions of dollars that are flying around through these interbank pathways that get settled up in the right way. So at the end of the day, everybody says there are no real dollars here. There's no currency here, but we all agree these are the numbers that we have. Yeah, so you have this asset, I have this liability, and we're all set. Everything is settled out. And if it's not settled out, if I owe you more at the end of the day than you owe me, for example, then I can go into the repo market, or I can use the Federal Reserve. I can go to the discount. I mean, there are ways to settle imbalances on top of ways to transfer funds.
Even for that credit union?
Yes. Yeah, so the credit union doesn't necessarily need a reserve account. It could be a sponsored into chips, for example.
Chips
is another interbank settlement process, and chips is primarily the one that's used outside the U.S. So you have essentially the SWIFT system, which is nothing more than messages. So banks are sending messages back and forth that then get processed by either Fedwire or CHIPS. And if it's a foreign SWIFT foreign related SWIFT, chances are it's going to be settled in chips rather than Fedwire.
So what would the asset be there? Because obviously it's not green pieces of paper.
It's just number on my computer screen. I owe you this. Now I have an asset. You have a liability. I mean, it's all balance sheet mechanics.
It's just Wells Fargo basically giving the credit union an IOU.
Exactly.
That would be their asset, almost as if the credit union had a bank account with Wells Fargo or a checking account, let's say.
At that point, they do. If they want to settle it.
That's how.
If they want to settle it, say Wells Fargo was lending a credit union in repo, not that a credit union would be using repo, but.
It is any bank that doesn't have an account with the Fed.
It doesn't create a liability. It doesn't create a deposit liability anywhere, but it does create, it does change the balance sheet on both counterparties. So really all we're doing is changing balance sheet numbers in each place.
Yeah. Yeah, I just didn't know what the technical asset would be. But I guess, again, that the technical asset would just be a liability of Wells Fargo saying, we're transferring you a liability with this George Gammon guy's name on it. So you've got to put that as a liability on your balance sheet because that's an asset on George's balance sheet. He's got an account with you. But the offsetting asset is Wells Fargo saying that credit union, we owe you $1,000.
Right, and from the credit union perspective, they book it as cash and equivalents because it's a cash equivalent, which is nothing more than an electronic message, an electronic interbank message that says Wells Fargo owes me this much money.
Yeah.
Which, again, nobody ever wants actual cash, so the fact that they did the electronic transfer is cash.
Yeah, that's I drew pictures of the balance sheets last night. And that's kind of how I was thinking it through, like almost like the credit union would have a bank account like you or I would with a bank that did have an account with the Fed Reserve account. And then if that process happened, then they could, as an example, if they had a bank account with Bank of America, then Wells Fargo could transfer that down to their account. Then the reserves would go from Wells Fargo down to Bank of America. How would it work?
Yeah, we don't need reserves for that, though. That's the point, I think, is that, you don't need reserves to settle those transactions. It can be a private bank liability. It doesn't need to be Fed money.
Between Wells Fargo and Bank of America?
Absolutely. Again, like I said, before 2008, before there were a lot of bank reserves, that's how everything got done. It was settled in, not necessarily in reserves, but bank cash, for lack of a better term.
Which is just ledger entries.
Right. It's just instead of, why do we need to transfer Federal Reserve balances between ourselves when I've got my own kind of transfers I can make for you?
Scribbling on this piece of paper.
It's a ledger. That's all it is. That's what we're talking about. And that's why, the presentation at your conference, they talked about this M2 stuff and ledger money, ghost money. I mean, this is a process, or this is a way of doing money and banking that goes back a long, long ways. And it's simply a decentralized ledger system that, in the case of the Eurodollar system, isn't as decentralized as, say, a cryptocurrency would be, which would be open to everybody. The decentralized ledger is basically these, like I said, chips or Fedwire, all of these systems that are in place where the banks who are connected to them, they're the ones keeping the ledgers. And so they all know about the ledgers because they're settled daily in these interbank processes. Whereas, those from the 14th and 15th century, the ghost money ledgers were just, it was a shared ledger between a group of merchants in a particular city or region. So it wasn't very widely distributed. And then cryptocurrency is essentially a ledger.
But it's the same thing. At the end of the day, it's the same thing. It's just a piece of paper with some writing on it. Whether it's electronic or whatever you want to say, it's just
the entries on the ledger are money and tokens themselves.
Yeah, right. That's right. Okay, so then thinking through it with, let's say that I'm purchasing a car or something. Let's say dollars are going outside of the United States. Bottom line. So because the way I think of it, I always think of dollars or electronic dollars. It's got to be a liability of someone. It's either a liability of the commercial banking system, or in the case of bank reserves, it's a liability of the Fed, or even with these ledger systems, the dollars on that ledger are a liability of some commercial bank or some entity like that. Or it's got to be a liability of some bank entity, I guess, whether it's the Fed or commercial bank or even a bank outside the U.S., I guess. So how would it work if a dollar liability that I transfer, let's say you live in Germany, as an example, and I transfer you $1,000, and you've got a dollar account with your German bank. So that dollar liability goes from my bank to your bank. So now it's your asset. So how would that be the same type of ledger system? Or I guess that bank could have an account with the Fed too, because I saw on their diagram that a lot of foreign banks actually do have accounts with the Fed. But again, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a transfer of reserves. It could just be the ledger system.
It's foreign banks don't have any accounts with the Fed. They have to set up U.S. subsidiaries in order to have an account with the Fed. The Fed does not do anything outside the U.S. except with other central banks in these dollar swaps. And they're very particular about that because of the reasons I always go back to is the Federal Reserve is not a central bank. It's not a dollar central bank. It's a domestic bank regulator.
Right,
its power and authority ends at the U.S. border. So if you're a foreign bank and you want to do business with the Federal Reserve or you want to be plugged into the Federal Reserve system, you have to set up a U.S. subsidiary. So from the Fed's perspective, and they're legally correct about this, they only do business with domestic banks because a U.S. subsidiary of a foreign bank is technically a U.S. bank.
Even if it's like HSBC or Deutsche. They have a
subsidiary. And if you go back to 2007 and 2008 during the first financial crisis, that's who was participating in the TAF auctions. And these all of these liquidity auctions and liquidity programs. If you go back and look at the TAF records, which various people had to get out ahead,
pull
from the Federal Reserve.
Explain that really quick.
In the early days of the crisis, going back to 2007, what the Fed decided to do was auction bank reserves. So they had the first TAF auction, which TAF stands for Treasury Auction Facility, whatever it's called. Essentially, the Fed said it's a way to increase the level of bank reserves to give them out into the banking system without doing anything permanent like quantitative easing. They didn't want to do quantitative easing at that point. And in fact, they actually wanted to sterilize these TAF auctions. But essentially, these were liquidity auctions by the Fed, auctioning bank reserves to the banking system, but not to the global banking system, only U.S. banks. Only U.S. banks were eligible to participate. But when we got the list of banks that actually participated years later, more than half of the banks that were bidding for these bank reserves from the Fed were U.S. subsidiaries of foreign banks.
So that's
a clue here. This is a global dollar problem, not a local dollar problem.
Okay.
So what would happen then is now the U.S. subsidiary has liquidity in the form of bank reserves, which could free up some liquidity elsewhere that would likely be transferred between the U.S. subsidiary and its foreign parent. That was probably undergoing some degree of pressure and strain. But that's, again, that's the point. The first global financial crisis was a global dollar shortage. And that was one way you could see this happening. Obviously, we didn't have the list of names in real time. But the fact that it was for U.S. subsidiaries of foreign banks that were largely, bidding up these bank reserves that were auctioned in these TAF auctions told you that it was an outside U.S. dollar problem is more than it was an inside U.S. dollar problem.
You think the dollar denominated debt, I'm thinking through that and through the lens of what Brent talks about. I'm just thinking, so do you think is because the dollar denominated debt got to an extreme in the shadows prior to the GFC and the velocity slows down, so there's just not enough dollars out there, and that was the trigger? Is there any way of knowing?
Well, as we talk, I'm glad you started out the way you started out, because thinking along these things in the lines of bank balance sheets, we're just trading, how do we get more money into the system? Well, it's not the Fed prints currency, paper currency and adds. That doesn't work. It's not bank reserves either, because bank reserves tend to pool up only in a small, primary dealers and small part of the system.
Right.
The way you add euro dollars to the euro dollar system is by banks adding to their balance sheet, growing their balance sheets and
lending,
not just lending, but it can be all sorts of, creating deposit liabilities to pay for treasuries. I mean, that's a way of balance sheet expansion. It all comes down to bank balance sheet expansion. And what happened in 2007 was banks said, holy crap, all this stuff that we thought was riskless, all this crap that we've been doing that nobody understands, collateral securities lending, all this other stuff. Well, it turns out it's really risky. And because it's really risky, the more I do, the more risk I take. And so I'm not going to do any more. I'm going to actually slow down what I do. So bank balance sheet in the aggregate started to slow its growth and then actually in 2007, 2008, contracted.
And then you have more counterparty risk in the system between the entities doing business. And then that exacerbates the problem, I would assume.
It becomes a self-reinforcing process where, you know, one major dealer pulls back, which causes another dealer to pull. Mm-hmm. And it's all very incestuous, too, because when a dealer's laying off risk, he's laying off risk to the next dealer. So if that dealer says, I don't want your risk, then you stop laying off risk, too. It's a recipe for an uninterruptible implosion. Right. And that's really what happened, because how is the Fed going to stop balance sheets from shrinking? With bank reserves? That doesn't help. I mean, there's all sorts of these different forms. You know, think about collateral, think about derivatives. Credit default swaps were a huge thing because of how they were used in maintaining bank balance sheets and creating leverage on bank balance sheets. So, I mean, the Federal Reserve's essentially at the end, and, you know, after everything, after the dust started to settle in 2008, September and October 2008, it wasn't about bank reserves anymore. It was about Maiden Lane. It was about taking on AIG's credit default swap portfolio or some of its dealer businesses, because bank reserves don't really matter to the system that had been, that spent decades doing all these other things except bank reserves.
So my when you're saying that, my question was going to be, so what got us out of the GFC? Why wasn't it worse? And it sounds like just because through the balance sheet, you know, scribbles on the piece of paper, they were able to instill confidence, which motivated, incentivized the banks to start expanding their balance sheet again. Is that correct?
No.
No, okay. Not even close.
They did all that stuff September and October 2008. There was overseas dollar swaps. Forget the TAF auction. Let's just do, you know, blanket liquidity auctions. In fact, the Fed thought it had gone so far that it started to soak up reserves with reverse repos and IOER and all these other things. Hmm. But, you know, that was September, October 2008. Crisis didn't end till March. And remember, between September 2008 and March 2009, that's when the global economy took its worst hit.
Right.
So it wasn't like the Fed was effective. And eventually what stopped the crisis in March 2009, I'm absolutely convinced, and it's an arguable proposition, but to me, it's the evidence is clear. It was FAS 157.
Which
was market. When the Federal Reserve and the accounting regulators said you no longer have to mark to market your unmarketable or illiquid assets, that interrupted the chain, which caused balance sheet contraction in its biggest form. Like Citigroup, for example. Citigroup took, and I'm going off the top of my head, I think something like 20 some billion in losses in the third quarter of 2008, which was biggest loss ever. But it wasn't a real loss. It was an illiquid market loss. It was an OTTI, other than temporary impairment, that was required and forced upon it by FAS, whatever the existing accounting standard was before 157, which said, you know, as these markets became more and more illiquid and prices kept going down and down, banks had to write down the value of their assets, which only caused other banks to say, I don't want to do any more money dealing activities anyway, because everybody's in danger of being going bankrupt. On paper. And the thing is, those ETDI and OTTI impairments were just paper losses from illiquid marketplaces. And once those stopped, there was no longer that huge, heavy liquidation, banks are going out of business type of negative pressure and perception that allowed at least the rest of the system to stop and say, okay, let's take stock of where we are. We've destroyed a hell of a lot of money and a lot of leverage. Maybe that was enough to get the system into a settled state. And as it turned out, without that pressure from mark to market, it was enough to create a settled state. It's just an incredibly destructive settled state.
Yeah, right. So just for the terms of the average Joe and Jane might be able to fall a little easier. Basically, you got a house that you buy for $100,000. And so when you buy it, its value is $100,000. So that's an asset on your balance sheet. And but then what happens is the market tanks. You still own the home. You're still getting your rental payments. Let's say it's a rental property. But yet the value of the house goes from $100,000 down to $50,000. Well, it still doesn't really matter to you at all. You're still getting positive cash flow from it. But it really hampers your ability to borrow more money, because the bank looks at your balance sheet and it's half the size as it was based on your cost basis. And that's kind of what we're talking about.
And that's exactly what we're talking about. And it's because the price of your home went down because your neighbors they were forced to sell because they didn't have they didn't have the liquidity buffers and margins to maintain themselves with falling prices, which only, you know, when you get into that kind of situation, it only contributes to the mess because their distressed sales and liquidations only force prices down even more. And soon, you know, you get so far away from economic fundamentals, nobody cares anymore. In fact, everybody at that point, the only thing anybody cares about is liquidity. And that's, right. You know, a system cannot function, a monetary and financial system just cannot function where everybody's sole concern is liquidity. Because eventually in that situation, everybody's simply going to hoard it. And they're going to hoard every single form of it, which is the exact opposite that you need for a healthy functioning system and economy.
When did the pre-GFC mark-to-market rule go into effect?
Oh, I think it's been, it's not something that was abnormal. I mean,
I'm just wondering, because that seems like it would have triggered way before that. It just seems like a ticking time bomb that just would have triggered often. You see what I'm saying?
Sure, but like everything else, George, it had there was a place for it, and it had, securitization, for example. This is what it really came from. Securitization was a good idea. It just got way out of control and bastardized and used for all the wrong purposes and then used too much. But right. Securitization, if it had been left to a niche kind of a section of the market, yeah, you can take illiquid assets and make them liquid. There's always this desire, it's a legitimate desire on the part of the banking system to look at illiquid assets. I mean, mortgage loans, they're illiquid assets. Mm-hmm. So how do you value mortgage loans? Well, the bank has a tremendous incentive to do that. They want to be able to value stuff that's illiquid. So securitization was one way you can make it liquid. Plus, you can make a repoable collateral out of it. But apart from that, you can create all these illiquid assets or pools of assets and try to create some kind of valuation to them. So you have liquid mortgage-backed securities that trade on the market, which you then presume tell you something about the value of these illiquid, non-tradable assets that are on your books.
Which was a 30-year mortgage.
It makes sense in that context, yeah. Except if these liquid mortgage-backed securities over here start trading haywire. The conditions in that market go nuts, and it becomes the value of these mortgage bonds go down and down and down because of things like credit default swap problems and a bunch of other stuff we don't need to get into. But that has nothing, correlation trading, for example, has nothing to do with the fundamental value of these illiquid loans that are on your balance sheet. But yet you have to mark to these mortgage bonds that are liquid because that's what the accounting rule in the law says.
Right.
Even though the true economic value, money good assets on your books, they haven't lost any value. They're not experiencing wave of defaults or anything, but you have to mark to this other market price that's going nuts.
Right, to where you could be cash flow positive, but you're insolvent.
It's money good assets that are valued by inputs that are inappropriate. Mm. And when the bank said that in 2007 or 2008, everybody said, "Oh, it's Wall Street just trying to get away with something here." But that was an actual true part of the crisis, that there was a mark to market problem. And once the regulators finally realized it needed to sever that relationship. It again, as I said, it allowed the system to kind of take a step back and say, okay, how bad are things? Right. Because up until March 2009, we've been valuing all of everything, all this illiquid stuff, based upon really bad illiquid inputs from stuff that did trade. And once you didn't have to do that anymore, things didn't look as bad. I mean, yeah, it was really bad. It wasn't good, but it wasn't like end of the world, everybody's going out of business type stuff anymore, because you could finally say, Citigroup could say legitimately, most of these assets I've been marking down, I didn't need to mark them down. And I don't need to mark down any more assets because they really are money good. And it's just this trading inputs from the stuff that traded in illiquid markets that was causing all these problems. Which, if you think about it, points a huge finger back in the direction of the idiots at the Federal Reserve. Because the big problem was markets going illiquid, which, I mean, I was told from a young age, as you probably were,
yeah, the lender that's the last Fed's resort.
Job, right?
Yeah, the lender money last supply. Resort.
So as much as the Fed wanted to blame subprime mortgages and did over and over, when you actually take a step and look at it, one thing after another, the Federal Reserve was just a complete, utter mess. Total incompetence up and down.
How could they have provided lending as far as in that time frame, during 2008, 2009, what could they have done or what should they have done maybe to provide, to be the lender of last resort, to do their job?
I think the problem had gotten to be so big that there is no chance. I mean, first of all, you would have to, I mean, the Fed could use 13-3 for a lot of purposes, and they did. I mean, the Maiden Lane stuff was pushing it, the bailout of AIG and some of the Citigroup assets. I mean, there was a lot. I mean, the Fed stretched the boundaries, but in order to have been even theoretically or plausibly effective in 2007, 2008, the Federal Reserve would have had to have rewritten itself completely, top to bottom, refurbish what they actually did. Because I've said ever since, you know, Bear Stearns failed, if the Fed wanted to have any prayer of forestalling the crisis, they probably should have taken over AIG's credit default swap business. And I don't mean buying the assets and putting on Maiden Lane and just sheltering them away. I mean actually writing credit default swaps to other, I mean becoming the credit default swap market itself. Because the default swap market defined, especially for banks outside the U.S., especially for banks in Europe, they were using credit default swaps for something called regulatory capital relief, which was essentially gaming their balance sheets to make them to be able to pile more leverage into them. We don't need to go into the details of that either. But essentially, without credit default swap, with AIG having experienced trouble, banks, especially in Europe, but you know, pretty much anywhere, the default swap market defined leverage on balance sheets. And so without the default swap market functioning, it caused essentially a collapse in balance sheet capacities.
Right. So it'd basically be like an internal repo. If the Fed were to do that, which is kind of what they're doing now. So let's go on to that topic with reverse repo. And I've been listening. I don't know if I've listened to all of your episodes on it with Emil. I've tried to because, you know, I think you guys pointed out, which I'm just trying to get my head around, the fact that, a couple things here. And I know you don't care about M2, but I find it interesting that right in April, pretty much the exact same, I don't know if it's the exact same day or just right around the same time frame for sure in April, where reverse repos really started to spike. And then you saw the way the Fed measures it, you know, M2 kind of flatten out. But then since then, you saw the 10-year yield start to trend down. That's where it really reversed.
It's absolutely clear inverse correlation. March 18th, you know, the 30-year Treasury hit its top. March 19th, the 10-year did. And that was the same exact day that the reverse repo started to get usage. Mm-hmm. And it's let's be clear here. It's not that the reverse repo is causing this deflationary perception in the long-term bond market. It's that both are reactions to essentially the same thing. And I'm oversimplifying here. There's lots of different things going on. I mean, most people, what they're told, and this is true, is that there's quote unquote too much money. There's too many bank reserves. The Fed has created so many bank reserves from continuing to do QE. Plus the US government is drawing down the TGA account, which is absolutely happening. Mm-hmm. So there are money market funds that are stuffed to the gills with cash and they have no place to put it. So the reverse repo is a good place. In fact, that's really what the reverse repo is supposed to do. That's the whole point of the reverse repo. If it ever gets to a situation where money markets become overloaded with cash, you go to the Fed to take some of that cash off the market. It takes pressures off of interest rates. Interest rates can rise a little bit to where they're, you know, the Fed's more comfortable with them. And so in that sense, the reverse repo has functioned as it's supposed to. It's soaked up excess reserve.
But the crazy thing is it happens all at once. Sloping thing, okay, this makes sense. But the fact that it happens right on March, one day or like 2 days, yeah, like it just goes parabolic. You're like, wait a minute here. That can't just be the money market funds being overstuffed with cash.
And I'm glad you're thinking along that way because hardly anybody else does. Everybody takes the too much money explanation at face value and says, okay, that sounds like it makes sense. And that's really the first clue that's not right. Because it was March 18th, all of a sudden, for reasons we can't fathom, I mean, I think that the balance in the reserve account for the Fed was like $4.926 trillion. Why was that the trigger point for this major reverse repo? Why did that unleash? I mean, wasn't.
Yeah, like if there would have been a dollar less or something, it wouldn't have happened. Right. You know,
why was it the $3.926 trillion? You know, why was that dollar the one that triggered the RRP? And it wasn't. And I think what happened was you saw bill yields drop in that middle part of March, which to me, that's always a sign of excess demand for collateral, because bills are the best of the best of the best collateral form. It's the most pristine of the pristine collateral. And if there's ever, I mean, you saw this in March 2020 very clearly. This is what they're, what the, even the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has finally realized, is they called it a scramble for collateral. When that happens, you see bill yields drop, because bill yields are the best form of collateral. So you saw that in mid-March, which already suggested something's going on here, shortage of collateral. And at the same time, the Treasury Department, because of the debt ceiling issue, Janet Yellen's they're refunding a lot of bills. They shut down a couple of cash management issuances. They've cut back in some of the regular bill issuance. So there's a supply issue there as well. And, you know, middle March, drop in bill yields, that's already got our radar up for collateral. And what is the reverse repo anyway? The reverse repo is essentially a Federal Reserve substitute for private counterparties repo. In other words, if you're a cash-rich money market fund, and you're eligible to do business with a reverse repo, which most of them are, you have a choice. I can do a repo arrangement with the private market at X, or I can do a repo arrangement with the Federal Reserve where I lend the Fed cash and they give me collateral back. And it's the same collateral. It's treasuries out of the SOMO.
It's just a different counterparty.
Exactly. And so, I mean, for a money market fund, it's almost like a perfect substitute. And so, but right there, I mean, that sounds like too much cash, but it's not. What if the money market fund goes into the private repo market, but has trouble locating a counterparty wanting to borrow your money with the right collateral? What if they don't have, the market doesn't have enough collateral? Well, in that case, you would go to the Fed too, because the Fed is the only one that does have collateral, because they've sucked away so much of it and put it in SOMA. They have trillions upon trillions in assets available. So even if money market funds are going to the reverse repo, it could also be, yes, too much money. They have they're cash rich. But it could also be that the private market, the private repo market, doesn't have enough collateral. So there aren't enough collateral sufficient borrowers to soak up the excess reserves. And so
do you think it could be because of maybe in the shadows there's an increase in counterparty risk? Because if I'm the money market fund and I can get treasuries or T-bills, let's just say they could get the collateral in the private market, but you have lunch with your buddy that works at HSBC or whatever, and he's telling you, dude, we got problems. And then you're like, okay, and you're that money market fund manager. You're like, okay, I get it. I want my counterparty to be the Fed now. So I'm going to move all my money over there.
George, that part doesn't necessarily matter, because as the money market fund, you're collateralized. You have the treasury bill as collateral, the treasury bond, if you're using that, because we do know dealers are extending their maturities on their inventory. So, I mean, where that counterparty aversion might come in is one step removed from that, from the end user who's using treasuries to borrow in the repo market from the money market funds. Where did they get the treasury in the first place? Chances are it's been borrowed.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah, it's rehypothecated. So do you want to...
So the phone call is not with the money market fund, hey, I'm worried about it. It's really between the end cash borrower who's borrowed the treasury and the dealer who he's borrowed it from. The dealer's going to say, you know, you've given me junk collateral and I've given you a treasury in return. And yeah, that's a nice thing, but I don't like the junk that you've posted to me. Give me my treasury back.
Or I don't like the risk that I'm taking with you because you're going out of business, or, you know, going back to GFC or something like that.
Or you seem to be a little more risky. I was charging you, you know, 30 basis points for our collateral swap. Now I'm going to charge you 130. And I can't afford that. It's, you know, I need to do it at 30, or otherwise I can't, you know, we have to unwind our position, which means I no longer have a treasury. I've got to unwind further positions, and it causes the collateral multiplier to not collapse, but shrink. And whenever the collateral multiplier shrinks, what that does is it sucks liquidity out of the system because there's insufficient collateral. And all of these things, I think, are coming together with what we see in the reverse repo. And I, you know, the fact that you pointed out it was, bam, it just showed up one day in mid-March. Mm-hmm. Connect that with bills, connect that with the sudden turn out of reflation in long-term notes and bonds into what is now a pretty clear increase in deflationary potential. All of that intersected right at the same time. And when you look at it in this fashion, you can see that this can't be the abundance of money, because the abundance of money would be inflationary. If this was too much money running around, didn't matter if it ended up in the reverse repo. I mean, that would be an inflationary thing. And if it was truly inflationary, none of this money would end up in the reverse repo anyway, because banks would be only too willing to not own treasuries because they thought inflation was coming. The last thing you want to own is treasuries if you think it's inflationary. So right. Everything about this says there's a issue, a deflationary potential here that's only getting worse and worse and worse. And in fact, last week, Jay Powell actually admitted in testimony when he was asked about the reverse repo, is this too much money? And he said, no, there's a shortage of safe short assets. We don't have a lot of T-bills.
I heard you guys talking about that.
Yeah, and that's Jay Powell admitting to Congress. Now, you could say, well, he's just covering his ass because he was being questioned about, you know, you're doing too much QE. And he can say, well, no, it's not us. You can't blame us. It's Treasury. Treasury's not issuing enough Treasury bills, which is true. So, I mean, but again, you put all of these things together. There's a collateral issue that's collateral scarcity has gotten so big and so obvious that even Jay Powell is telling congressmen about it.
Right.
And but it's the way to explain all of these things going on at the same time.
Yeah, I think you may have answered my question, because I was going to say, a question that I was going to ask is that, because I was going to say, all right, well, is it a shortage of collateral in and of itself, or is it a shortage of collateral relative to the amount of cash in the system? Is it easy? Because I think those things are two completely separate components. But I think you're saying that
what you're saying, right? There's an increase in cash, and then there's not an increase in collateral to match it. And
so therefore that argument, like Zoltan would have, which I want to get into in a second, which it is a cash issue, you know, that it is a liquidity issue. You could say, well, I guess maybe it could be a collateral issue and a liquidity issue from the standpoint, if you look at it through the lens of there's not enough collateral for the amount of cash. But that's different than saying there's just not enough collateral, period, for the system to function.
Right. And I don't think it matters either way. To me, it doesn't really matter. If you have a mismatch of collateral to cash.
Yeah, Jeff, was if we had too much cash for the amount of collateral, then we'd see the inflationary pressures. We'd see the long end of the curve go up.
And you would see dealers expanding their balance sheet to raise the collateral multiplier to match the cash. And that's where I was going, is that
what's the collateral multiplier?
Collateral multiplier is a concept where you realize that each, you know, this specific definition, which is kind of misleading. But anyway, it's every treasury that goes into the dealer system, it gets reused, repledged, repurposed, rehypothecated, a certain number of times.
Okay. Oh,
so the collateral multiplier is how many times it gets reused. And most
so it's like fractional reserve collateral.
It's exactly what it is. And most mainstream academic studies, and there are not many because hardly anybody knows they should be looking at it, but the few studies that have been undertaken by the Fed or the IMF, the BIS, they think that the collateral multiplier is somewhere between 6 and 8. Huh. So, I mean, it sounds like a treasury goes into the dealer network and it gets reused 6 or 8 times to support all of this other financial activity. That's not really true. That's just how we kind of estimate it based on the number of treasuries we know go in and the number of repo and other things that are supported by that number of treasuries. So it's sort of a fudge number. It's not really a real number, but it's a number that helps relate the concept of the collateral multiplier, fractionalization of collateral.
Yeah.
But you talk to people in the repo business and they'll tell you that probably the real effect of collateral multiplier is 20 or 30 or something much larger.
Wow. Because
banks are really good at this stuff. I mean, think about Lehman Repo 105. They know what they're doing and how to manipulate numbers and balance sheets and things like that. So, but what the overall point is that there is a collateral goes in, it gets multiplied, but it's not a static multiplier. It's a dynamic multiplier.
Mm.
That multiplier changes based upon the behavior of the dealers in the system. Are they able and willing to repledge and rehypothecate? Sometimes when they're, you know, 2017 is a perfect example. When they thought, hey, globally synchronized growth, inflation, things are looking a little better, they rehypothecated, reused, and repledged a little bit more, which helps support it a little bit better function in markets. And
right.
Treasury yields sold off and things like that.
Which would imply that we did not have a collateral shortage or less of a collateral shortage.
It was less of a problem. Right. We had a collateral shortage, but it wasn't as bad. But, you know, a year later in 2018, especially May 29th, 2018, all of a sudden there are any number of alarm bells going off where you could say the collateral multiplier is shrinking again. This is going to be a huge problem. Lo and behold, end of 2018, what happens? We get the deflationary wave and treasuries and collateral and all these other things. So the point here is that collateral is not a static system where there's a single multiplier. It's based upon the behavior of dealers. So going back to what we were just arguing or what we're just talking about.
Yeah, with the counterparty risk.
Is it too much cash and not enough collateral to meet the cash? If the dealer system was not risk averse, was not deflationary, then it would expand the multiplier to meet the level of cash because there would be incentives to do it. So whether or not there's too much cash for the level of collateral, it almost doesn't matter. What does matter is there's an imbalance that tells us the dealers aren't matching collateral for cash, whatever level of cash. Right. And that's the important point. And then you have to ask, well, what is going on with dealers that they're not able or willing to do this? Now, on the ability side, Treasury is refunding, they're shrinking their debt offerings. That's a supply issue. That's a problem. But also the willingness side. You know, as much as the media is positive about inflation and growth and talking about the economy doing gangbusters, the truth is very, very different, especially outside the United States. The U.S. goods economy has gone through the roof. It's gone crazy. But that's basically the only place in the global economy that has. You look at China, for example. You look at Europe, for example. Around the rest of the world, there's not a lot that's good. So you can understand why dealers, because this is a global money system, would say, I don't want to repledge and rehypothecate as much as I did maybe in January. Because January, everything looked great. We got vaccines. We've got Uncle Sam. We've got, you know, everybody's reopening. Then you get to March and April and you think, that's it. This wasn't really as good as I thought it was. And oh, by the way, the Chinese are telling you they're not doing any more. So there's a lot more risks built up. And where that comes to a head with all of this stuff, T-bills, reverse repo, deflationary and long-term treasuries, is where are the dealers? Why aren't the dealers expanding their why aren't they becoming less risk averse and doing the things that would keep these imbalances from becoming so large?
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I think that's so crucial too, and that's a mistake I always make, is I think of the U.S. as a system, the domestic system.
Yeah.
And then I think of it, the globe, right, as another. I always think of it as the dollar domestic system, and then the outside of that is the euro dollar system. But right. But to your point, they're one and the same. So if we're sitting here thinking about our grocery bill going up at the grocery store, and then trying to figure out what the hell is going on, you've got to not only consider what your overall expenses are doing, but also what the person's expenses are doing that lives in Turkey or that lives in Germany or South Africa, something like that. Because you can't just look at what your P&L is. You've got to look at what the globe's P&L is and then go from there.
Yeah, and that's when you look at
the inflation. And when I talk about P&L, I'm just talking about the amount you're paying, your expenses going
in. And that's why when you look at U.S. Treasury yields, for example, they're not telling you what's going on specifically in the U.S. economy. They're not talking about inflation and growth expectations in the U.S. economy. Treasury yields are reflecting the entire global economy. So what falling treasury, and it's not just, I mean, global yields tend to behave in very correlated fashion. So if you see treasury yields falling, dollars to donuts, you're going to see German bond yields falling. You're going to see JGB yields falling. You're going to see Aussie bonds falling. AGS is falling. And that's exactly what's happened since late February, mid-March. The global bond yield, the global bond market has been saying it's not Australian deflation. It's not European deflation. It's global deflation potential has risen for all of these reasons. You know, we have a monetary problem in the global reserve currency system again for the fifth goddamn time. And we also have a lot of negative stuff going, you know, the recovery. We've got COVID on the rise in certain places. I mean, there's all sorts of negative potential that suggests why we see all of these things in such correlated fashion.
Yeah, that's making a lot more sense now. Okay, I'm thinking, I think you've really helped me think far more clearly, especially with the balance sheet stuff and understanding how the liabilities and assets are transferred back and forth and how they balance out at the end of the night. And then think of that global system, that makes a lot more sense when you're trying to, you know, think through what on earth is happening with the long end of the curve in the treasury market. But yet with the domestic prices, how they can be so dramatically different. It's because you're just looking at a snapshot of the overall picture when you look at things domestically.
Yeah. And you can even see it in the CPIs, for example. The U.S. CPI is through the roof. We all know that.
Right.
But up until the last couple of months, the U.S. and, say, European CPIs or HICP and the PCE deflator, whatever, the HICP is what the Europeans use and the PCE deflator is what the Fed uses. You put those two together on a plot for the last, 20 some odd years, they match. U.S. inflation and European inflation are almost exactly the same. They behave in the exact same way, which tell, again, global money, global system.
Right.
They stopped matching when the U.S. CPI went ballistic a couple months ago. So that's already a clue that the U.S. is an outlier. It's not representative of what's going on in the global system. And therefore, you look at, why is Japanese inflation still at zero and negative levels? I think it just turned positive for the latest month. So, again, my point is that the U.S. part of the system and the U.S. goods part of the global system, yes, there's some transitory price pressures in there. How we know they're transitory is they're not being matched anywhere else around the world. And this is a global system. And it's made global and tied together by this global monetary system that keeps making all the wrong kinds of noises. There's all sorts of creaks and cracks and alarm bells going off in that system that are saying the U.S. inflation numbers are going to eventually match everyone else's, and everyone else's inflation numbers are going to come down again because we're heading into potentially another deflationary system. Now, we haven't gone...
Or disinflation, to where disinflation, if inflation's at 10%, even though it goes down to 4%, we still have inflation, but that's highly disinflationary because we're going from 10 down to 6 or 4 or whatever. Yeah.
And let's also be clear. We're talking about probabilities here. When bond yields fall like they have, they're not saying, deflation is definitely coming. What they're saying is that the growth and inflation potential, each of those have fallen. So the probability of growth and inflation over a certain, determinable time period has diminished substantially. So that's really what we're saying. Lower bond yields aren't saying, inflation's impossible. It's never going to happen. What they're saying is that it's such a low chance that it's a huge outlier that we're going to see any kind of sustained inflation. And that really we're reverting to the base deflationary problem that we've had since August of 2007.
Yeah. Yeah, another mistake I was making is putting too much emphasis on bank reserves, because I was looking at the Fed's liabilities and, the reserve accounts. You got the TGA, you got reverse repo. And if you have, let's just say, 4 or 5 trillion of bank reserves total, and a trillion of those, 20% or 25% are going down into reverse repo, you would think that would be deflationary, because that would, I always look at bank reserves as expanding the bank's balance sheet capacity to lend, right? But I'm putting too much emphasis on them.
Yeah, and I think, there's also, technically speaking, when the Fed engages in reverse repo with people, what happens is that reduces their bank reserve, their balance of bank reserves, and goes into reverse repo. But really, functionally, that's no different. It's the same thing. A reverse repo from the perspective of the banking system or the financial system, really, because we have a lot of money market funds participating, it's no different than bank reserves. So, there really isn't much change between bank reserves and reverse repo. And from the perspective of the Fed, it's nothing more than an accounting entry.
Right. But I know that. But would the banks still have access to those bank reserves if they were in reverse repo?
Well, it's tied up for overnight. But that's a voluntary exchange. It's the bank saying, I'm not going to do anything. I need a place to park my cash, so I'm going to use you.
Right.
What's the difference between having it at reserves paying IOER and, in reverse repo paying less, though.
Right.
So it's, again, it all comes back to...
The thing is, if the money market funds, because are the money market, is the dollars that the money market funds control, I was assuming they were liabilities of the commercial banking system.
Largely, right.
So when they do a reverse repo with the Fed as the counterparty, then let's say they have this money market fund XYZ has an account with Wells Fargo, and that's where their, you know, their dollars or liabilities of Wells Fargo or JP Morgan or whatever. And so then let's say they do $1 billion, they put it in reverse repo. So then the $1 billion of bank reserves go from JP Morgan's account, their reserve account, down into reverse repo. And so then, but JP Morgan, would they still have access to those bank reserves to use to back up more loans in the real economy, or they don't even need them because prior to the GFC, the whole system was running on $40 billion worth of reserves?
Well, they don't need them anyway because JP Morgan has tons of reserves anyway. I mean, that's where all this quantitative easing builds up. It builds up on the primary dealer's balance sheet. So yeah, JP Morgan's right. Probably not the example you want to use.
Okay.
But your larger point is correct, in that there is a redistribution process going on here. So let's say it's another bank, or really it's probably a hedge fund that is lending, that is borrowing in repo from a money market fund. Now it doesn't have the collateral to borrow in repo. So the collateral is the one that's causing the redistribution, not the money market fund choosing the reverse repo. The money market fund choosing the reverse repo is the effect. It is the effect of them not being able to lend to the hedge fund anymore because the hedge fund doesn't have the collateral.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So that's why we're linking the reverse repo to T-bills, but not as the reverse repo cause. The reverse repo is a symptom. It's a symptom of money market funds, largely, also primary dealers, going into the reverse repo because they can't find collateral adequate borrowers on the private marketplace. So the reverse repo is a signal, the same deflationary kind of a signal as falling treasury yields, because they both point in the direction of collateral scarcity. And collateral scarcity, before it becomes an outright shortage and dangerous outright shortage, collateral scarcity is deflationary potential.
Yeah.
In fact, it's really big deflationary potential, because when you look back at the history of the last 14 years, especially the first global financial crisis, collateral is at the center of all of it. Mm. Every global dollar shortage we go through has a tremendously important, key, crucial collateral shortage element to it.
Or collateral multiplier compression.
Right, which herds everybody into the best of the best collateral, which is why you see, for example, T-bill prices go through the roof, which means T-bill yields fall. I mean, there's a perfect example of this just on Tuesday morning. If you were paying attention to the bill market, 6 a.m. on the dot, the four-week Treasury bill yield went from about 4.5 basis points in the secondary market down to almost zero. And it stayed there for over, I think it was an hour and 15 minutes.
While reverse repos at 5 basis points.
Right. So in the secondary market, early morning trading, and this is a process we see repeated time and time again, but Tuesday morning was one of the most obvious, perfect examples of this collateral scarcity we're talking about. And remember what happened on Monday. Monday was a big downdraft in the Treasury market, deflationary potential building all over the world. That kind of stabilized in Asian trading overnight, but about 4, I think it was 4:40 in the morning Tuesday, I'm using Eastern times, you started to see Treasury yields fall again. So after a big down deflationary day on Monday, then you started getting deflationary worries building up on Tuesday morning. And then at 6 o'clock on the dot, scramble for collateral. T-bill yields plummet, mostly the 4-week, but I think the 3-month bill went down about 3 basis points. But there's obvious collateral, so obvious you can see it on the chart. The chart goes like this, you know. The point is that it couldn't have been too much money. It couldn't have been anything other than this collateral scarcity focused on that particular time in the early morning, which is not an isolated case. This is a pattern that has repeated time and time and time and time again. When we have the worst kinds of collateral issues, going back to March of 2020, going back to 2008, you see, because the collateral multiplier shrinks, becomes such a big problem, it herds everybody into either fire sales and liquidations because they have no way to fund their positions, or if you can get your hands on some treasury bills, you pay any price that's on offer. And yeah, that's why you see these
collateral. Even if you can get a higher basis point in IOER or reverse repo.
Yeah, that it's not about return at that point. It's all about liquidity and survival. And that's a good
point.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's when you see T-bill yields in particular drop below the reverse repo, you have to ask yourself why. because you could be lending to the Fed at 5 basis points. The Fed, I mean, there's no risk there at 5 basis points.
And getting the T-bills.
And getting back collateral, right. So why would you want to buy T-bills at, say, 4.5 or 3 or something else less than that? There's only one reason. It's because T-bills have a utility whose value is not determined by the investment characteristics. It's not about returns at that point. It's about balance sheet construction. I need to survive another day. And when you see a morning like Tuesday, you think, boy, there was a lot of people around the world who were in some serious crap who were forced to buy T-bills, 4-week T-bills at almost zero. Why were they doing that? Because they were just trying to make it through the day. Now, it didn't lead into any of the, you know, fire sales and liquidations, because remember, Tuesday afternoon or Tuesday morning and afternoon was actually reflationary. And so what that said was that got the collateral problem got to be so bad by Tuesday, you know, Monday, Friday over the weekend, Monday, it built and built, and Tuesday morning, 6 a.m., it all just broke. But it wasn't so bad that it led to a lot of liquidations and distressed sales. It caused the system to readjust into a lower settled state that was enough leverage destroyed, enough money destroyed that it was able to come to a settled state before it led to, you know, all of the bigger problems. So it's Tuesday morning was an absolutely perfect example of all of these things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in my mind, I'm just going back to that multiplier. That's so helpful because, you know, the obvious kind of quote unquote solution is Janet Yellen, or let's say the government just came together and could agree on something. And they said, okay, we have this collateral shortage of T-bills. Let's just go ahead and do a $10 trillion stimulus package. And at auction, we'll start borrowing, but only issue T-bills. You know, only issue T-bills. And then bam, now you're flooded with all these T-bills. But to your point, that might not even matter because if the dealers if there was something going on that they knew about that they were freaked out or they were freaking out over, then that contraction of the multiplier could wipe out the additional $10 trillion in T-bills, as mind-boggling as that is. And therefore, the access to collateral could be less with an additional $10 trillion in T-bills just because the multiplier shrinks.
Yeah, it's classic case of a bank run, right? Because that's what a bank run is, a fractional multiplier. There's not enough currency to service a drop in the multiplier, right? And that's all we're talking about here, except in collateral. Right. And it sounds strange, and I think, you know, maybe to some people it sounds a little too much like MMT, right? Because MMT's proposition is that the Fed or the federal government borrows money into existence. And that's kind of kind of sounds like we're talking about here. And that's really, in a lot of ways, that's what saved us last year, last April. Because what did the federal government do in April because of the CARES Act? And it actually started in the last couple of weeks of March. The Treasury Department knew the CARES Act was coming. They knew they were going to start borrowing. So they started issuing T-bills on March 23rd. Which just so happened to be where the crisis kind of ended. So last year, in the early days of the federal government's borrowing, they issued almost exclusively T-bills. So they essentially flooded the market late March and into April with Treasury bills. And that's kind of when the crisis ended. But of course, you know, the Treasury Department wasn't doing that because they were doing the Fed's job. They were doing that because they had to borrow and because they were, you know, the CARES Act required them to, the financial rescue and everything else. They accidentally gave the system the one thing it needed the most.
They accidentally did a good job.
Yes.
Let me take a second here. I've actually got, do you have a couple more minutes, Jeff? I know we're getting close to an hour.
For you, okay. Anything for you, George.
All right. So
we got to get you to settle down and stay in one place for longer than a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Like you're moving all over.
I know. Well, at least, you know, the place that I rented last time I was in Arizona was still available. So I was able to sign a 6-month lease on the same place where I was before. So that's good. So I wanted to go over to get your take. I thought it'd be interesting on Zoltan's article, not his article, but the article the Wall Street Journal did on his take of reverse repo. And because the big question that I had in my mind about what he was saying is if what he is saying is true, it doesn't really make sense to me that the T-bill market would be trading at a lower basis point than reverse repo, because his, not his whole thing, and I'll read his exact quote to you so I don't butcher it, or so I don't misrepresent what he's saying. But it seemed to me like he's saying that, well, the money market funds will just allow all the T-bills they have to mature, and therefore that liquidity will move into reverse repo because there's a higher basis point. And there you could see T-bill rates go up in this big shift of liquidity. But what didn't make sense to me is that you don't need to read the market.
You know, Zoltan's problem, and I don't really like attacking people like this, but look, the guy's been doing this for 3 years now, and he's been wrong about all of it. And the reason is because he focuses, everything to him is bank reserves. His entire world is the Federal Reserve and bank reserves.
He's like
he pays no attention.
I'm making the same mistake.
No, and it's an understandable thing, because we are told, and this message is reinforced day after day in the financial media. What do you say? I mean, quantitative easing. Every news story about quantitative easing says pour trillions of dollars into the real economy. None of that is true. But yet that we're told that over and over. We're told from Economics 101 forward, central banks are central. Everything they do matters. Bank reserves must be money because of open market operations and everything else that we've been taught from day one. And it's hard to break yourself free from that intellectual framework because it's reinforced so much. And it's one of those situations where he says, well, if everybody believes this, can everybody be wrong? And of course, history has shown, yes, everybody can be wrong. And there's a lot of situations where everybody is wrong. And this is one of them. So if you're examining, if you set that stuff out of your mind and you sit and just examine the evidence, and just, I mean, we're just talking about the reverse repo this year, for example, and the behavior of T-bills and long-term treasury notes and the reverse repo, the evidence says I'm missing something. It can't be what the Fed says. It can't be what everybody says, because nothing is behaving the way it's supposed to. So even just looking at the reverse repo, you're left thinking, I'm missing a big part of the equation here. I'm missing a big chunk of what's going on. And Zoltan's analysis, when he was with the Office of Financial Research, I think it was, 2015 and before, he did a lot of good work mapping out shadow conduits and things like that. Then he moved over to Credit Suisse. I'm not really sure what happened, but his analysis became so focused on bank reserves, pays no attention to repo and collateral whatsoever, which has always been his problem. But, it became even more focused on bank reserves and everything else. He spent 2018, 2019 screaming about how treasury yields are going to go to the moon because there's too many treasuries. And of course, that didn't happen either, because he didn't factor anything else other than bank reserves and Federal Reserve monetary policy. To him, quantitative tightening was the whole thing. The lack of bank reserves was going to sink the treasury market. And of course, the opposite exactly happened, for all the reasons have nothing to do with bank reserves. So when people hear Zoltan, I mean, just put it on ignore, because there's nothing there. It's going to be a very small section, a small sectional analysis that is totally incomplete. And it's going to leave off the important stuff. And if you follow it, you're going to look at the markets and be completely confused, because the markets are not going to behave the way he says they do.
You know, it's funny, you say ignore him. And in that Wall Street Journal article, they gave me credit for bringing him to more prominence in the mainstream. Let me read this. I think you'll probably get a kick out of this here. Let's see here. They're talking about Zoltan. Okay. And they say the episode where they're saying that he predicted the repo spike in 2019, that's the episode they're referring to. They said the episode was expanded, or the episode expanded his fame even beyond Wall Street. Financial YouTuber George Gammon spent nearly a half hour dissecting Mr. Pozar's analysis of the incident in a December 2019 episode. But here's the funny part: while poking fun at his subject's use of Wall Street vernacular. that's what they put in there, is me poking fun at his use of esoteric verbiage. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing about December 2019 in Zoltan was, up until that point, he had spent 2 years saying dealers were getting stuck with treasuries they didn't want. And I kept saying, because people would always ask me my opinion, I'd say, no, I mean, market prices prove conclusively that if dealers didn't want these treasuries, they could sell them for a profit. And the fact that they're not selling them for profit tells you the dealers want them. And then lo and behold, I think it was December 2019 or January 2020, Zoltan comes out and says, very meekly, very quietly said, oh, yeah, I said that the dealers were getting stuck with treasuries. Now it's very clear that they're choosing to hold them. And that wasn't a small footnote. That was basically him admitting, I got something very big, very wrong for a very long time. And the reason is because he focuses on only a small part of the overall system as if that's the whole system. Yeah. When you don't factor collateral, repo, derivatives, and everything else that goes on, he doesn't even think much about euro dollars and offshore money. I mean, he's looking at such a narrow section of the system and prioritizing bank reserves. It's no wonder he keeps making these huge mistakes. And for him to now say, "Oh, the treasury bill market's going to go through the roof."
Well, I don't want to. Let me read the exact quote because I don't want to. I don't want to throw him under the bus.
When money market funds no longer when the bills.
Here's what he says. He says we're talking about a big. Well, let me read the whole thing here so I'm not misquoting. It says Mr. Pozar doesn't expect a sharp rise in short-term yields. Instead, he predicts reserves will gradually shift away from banks to the reverse repo facility as money managers let short-term treasuries mature. Wall Street's casual attitude toward the shift underplays its uncertain consequences, which could include unexpected volatility, he said. Here you go. We are talking about a big rotation and quite a bit of money going from bills to the reverse repo facility. The more bills will be issued and someone will have to soak them up.
Right. And it's just too many treasuries argument just redone for the reverse repo and T-bills. And as we've seen in behavior of the bills, even today, I mean, the 4-week bill and the 8-week bill just got auctioned off this morning, each with a high yield of 4.5 basis points, which means most of these auctions were bought up at yields less than 4.5 basis points, even though the reverse repo today is 5.
Right.
And again, if you're Zoltan, you think that doesn't make any sense to me. Why would banks engage in such a negative carry? And the reason is because there's value in the negative carry. There's value in the utility that he doesn't even think about.
Is there, when I think of the, you know, the big banks just being completely, they just don't care about the yield on these T-bills. That's totally irrelevant. It could be 30 basis points. It could be zero. They just don't care because they need them for certain things. Is it usually that they need them for, I don't want to say security issues, but to shore up their balance sheet? Or do they want them because they can somehow use them to get a higher yield than they can get in IOER or any or in another place? You know, as an example, they could buy them at 3 basis points, but it doesn't matter because the way they can use them, they can earn, let's say, 100 basis points doing something else in the market through some sort of financial engineering. Or is it they're just willing to pay those 3 basis points or willing to accept that price because they just need them at any cost, not because they want to use them to make money, but they want to use them to
they
need them for their balance sheet. Yeah, it's not that they want them, that they need them. I guess
George,
that's the
it's all of these things. Dealers need them for their own balance sheet because remember, there's collateral multiply, which means they're reusing, rehypothecating other people's treasuries, which means they're synthetically short treasuries to begin with. So there's always going to be a value to. I mean, there's going to be times when they need to. Your short treasuries, you need to cover that position. You need to close that synthetic position. You got to go buy a T-bill at whatever price it at. So there's that. But there's also dealers who don't need these things for themselves, but they realize that hedge funds do. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to buy a T-bill at 4, you know, that yields 4.5 basis points, which means I'm paying a premium for it, knowing that I can lend it out to the hedge fund who's, you know, who's drowning in the pool because they don't have any repo access. I'm going to say, oh, I have T-bills for you, and I loaded up on them and got, you know, I thought ahead. I've got a whole inventory of T-bills. Yes, I overpaid for them, but I'm going to let you borrow them at an exorbitant rate because you're drowning, and you'll pay anything. So there are dealers who load up on securities thinking, I'm going to take advantage of the herding of everybody into T-bills, and if I buy the T-bills first, I'm going to have them and can charge whatever price I want to rent them out to everybody. So there's that.
So would they rent them out in repo? Because then we would see the yields go negative, right?
It's the securities lending or even a securities transformation transaction, which we can't observe anywhere. You know, as it gets back to the original problem, which is we have the collateral system, which is the central point of failure, because it's really the backbone of the entire global monetary system, yet we have no idea what goes on in it. We really don't. Nobody takes a look at it. There's no statistics. There's nothing. Securities lending, securities transformation. We know these things happen. We know they happen to a big degree, and they're important in determining the collateral multiplier and which direction it's going to go. No. Absolutely no idea what's really happening in those things. We kind of have to guess based on the behavior of all these marketplaces and try to figure out what is the only way we can identify that explains the way that all these markets are behaving. And when you look at what trading happened, you know, trading on Tuesday morning, and you see that obvious scramble for collateral when bill yields just collapse, you know what, I mean, it's such an obvious signal that, you know, you can't really miss it unless you listen to Zoltan.
Yeah. Zoltan, I'll have you on the show if you ever want to come on, buddy, and you can have a rebuttal and we can have a good back and forth, a respectful back and forth. But kind of based on what you were just saying there, and this was one question that I definitely wanted to ask you, but I think it kind of applies to how this operates in the shadows, and we just really don't know. It's because when I was reading the Fed's website, they were saying that when they are the counterparty in a reverse repo, the T-bills or whatever collateral they give in that reverse repo transaction stays on their balance sheet. So I'm like, okay, well, how can it stay on their balance sheet, but yet it goes on to someone else's balance sheet? And let's just say that it was a term repo. I don't know if they're doing that in reverse repo as a counterparty or it's all overnight, but let's say it was term.
No, they do have terms, but they don't happen very often.
Okay, but you know, if it was a term, then the money market fund or whatever could lend that out, and it could go to five different people on their, but the Fed still has it on their balance sheet.
That can't happen. You can't reuse or repledge Fed collateral.
Oh, okay.
So that's one of the reasons why when we're looking at the reverse repo usage, it's usually money market funds who can't find collateralized counterparties in the other markets. It's not like dealers are going in and saying, I'm going to grab some of the SOMA and start rehypothecating it. You're only going to use the reverse repo if it, you know, sort of is the last kind of collateral resort because there's no place else to do it.
So that's why 95% of the participants are money market funds
and not
primary dealer banks. Yeah.
Right. The Federal Reserve actually has a securities lending window where you can theoretically go to the Fed and rent collateral from them. But that never really gets used. I mean, I think it's about up to about $40 billion or so, which in the grand scheme of things is a drop in the bucket. And it hasn't really risen all that much. I mean, it used to be around 30 and 20 in years past. So it's gone up. But theoretically, you can go and rent collateral if you're short of collateral from the Fed. But again, there are restrictions and prohibitions on it there too. And dealers really don't like doing that. It's really, if you're synthetically short collateral in the marketplace, you're kind of left to the whims of the marketplace. There really isn't a lot of places to go. So again, when we see the reverse repo go up, it's not like that's a solution to the collateral problem. It's a symptom of it. And it's a symptom of it that's sort of, in my mind, useless. It's sort of like, okay, money market funds are shifting, leaving the original collateral problem unsolved, undealt with, and largely unappreciated because nobody really understands the IRP to begin with.
Yeah, and when the Fed's buying bills, it really exacerbates the problem, because before I understood about the collateral multiplier, I was assuming, okay, well, the Fed buys bills, and if they can, you know, if the market can still access them via reverse repo, well, then it's the collateral still getting back out into the system, but really it's not, because it's going back into the system with a multiplier of one instead of a multiplier of 30, and those two T bills are way, 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 way different.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, George, the Fed knows about. I mean, the Fed. There, you got to go back to October of 2019. After the repo mess, the Fed said, well, we're going to clean it up by raising the level of bank reserves, but we don't want to call it quantitative easing, so we're only going to buy treasury bills. And at that time, I said that was the worst possible thing they could do, because they're taking treasury bills out of circulation, which is the best of the best. And of course, it turned out that was exactly the problem. But in March, the week of March 18th, right in the thick of the crisis last year, the Fed stopped buying treasury bills. They realized, oh, we screwed up here. And ever since that point, actually, they bought a little bit more the next week, I think, a couple billion more. But ever since the week, I think it was March 25th or 26th of 2020, the Fed's SOMA holdings of T-bills has been exactly the same.
Yeah.
They've reinvested, but they haven't bought any more, which, I mean, again, if you just have the standard bank reserve view of things, this doesn't really make much sense and you don't know how to interpret it. But what it really is the Fed saying, oh, my God, we screwed up big here. We have a crisis where everybody's getting herded into treasury bills, and we've been removing hundreds of billions of treasury bills from circulation. Things got so bad, the thick of the crisis, we're just going to stop buying treasury bills and not tell anybody. We're not going to make a big deal out of it. We're just going to stop. And they haven't bought a single more bill. They've just reinvested ever since then.
But if they sell it, then if you're getting it from someone else, then you can go ahead and the multipliers, whatever the market.
The private market, yes, depending on the arrangement in which you obtain the treasury bill. If you bought it outright, then obviously you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, right.
If you got it from a hedge fund client in a custodial prime brokerage relationship, you probably have the right to do something with it.
But once the Fed sells it, then it can be multiplied, whatever the multiplier that the market's attaching title. To it. Yeah, once they,
That's one of the stupid parts about all this is you have to actually say, you know, when you buy a treasury bill, are you actually buying a treasury bill? Because, you know, reuse and rehypothecation in many ways looks like a purchase agreement. I mean, it's even called a repurchase agreement. Mm. But in fact, you're just there's no transfer of title there.
Yeah,
and that's really what the Fed is saying when it says, when I engage in these reverse repos, I leave these securities on our balance sheet because we're not relinquishing title. What we're really relinquishing is narrow rights that if we default on the cash borrowing, like, you know, so the money market fund lent us cash, they have the right to seize those securities and sell them.
Why don't they just do like an Operation Twist?
Who, the Fed?
Yeah, where they just buy more long term and then sell those bills without reducing the size of their balance sheet. So to get those bills back out in the system.
Because I don't think, you know, again, there's an appreciation that they screwed up, but there's no real appreciation for the wider implication of all this. And even now, it's, you know, there's $326 billion, I think, in the sum of bills in the SOMA portfolio, which is not a whole lot to sell.
Yeah, right. In the grand scheme of things, right.
Right. So, I mean, they could sell $300 billion and maybe they'd be done in a month. And then what?
But what do you think would happen if they just sold everything?
All the bills or all the bonds?
It just did QT, brought their balance sheet down to $800 billion, so all that collateral was back. I know the best is the T-bills, but still you're taking all that collateral and pushing it back out into the system. Do you think the market would panic just because they've got that Pavlovian QE thing where the market would tank and just the whole economy would collapse because of how dramatic that would be? Or do you think the opposite would happen and that we'd be off to the races because we'd have all this additional collateral that was being tied up by the Fed, or would that multiplier reduce because of all the increased risk in the system because the stock market go down? I mean, I guess there's a lot of different variables.
there's a lot of, I mean, but we had this situation in 2017, right?
Or they did QT,
the stock market loved it. Quantitative tightening was to the stock market catnip because it was the Fed saying, we're so confident that this globally synchronized growth stuff is real, we're actually going to shrink our balance sheet. And stocks, everything's awesome. We're bid. The bond market was a little more skeptical, not of quantitative tightening, but of globally synchronized growth. So it didn't matter that more collateral came into the system. You look at 2018, it was a collateral mess, even though the Fed was less of a hoarder in the collateral system. The collateral multiplier must have shrank anyway because 2018 was not inflationary. It turned out to be deflationary, and we had all sorts of collateral indications along the way. So it's not, I mean, you know, it's difficult to say what a future QT might look like. It really depends on the circumstances that they undertake the QT in. But I think initially, the Fed does anything, the market always receives it as, in the short run, as, oh, this is great, it's the Fed. Mm-hmm. And that's what we really need to break everyone from, is the habit of thinking everything goes through monetary policy and the SOMA and QE and the Federal Reserve, when in fact, it's all the important stuff takes place in places you can't see and observe except by indirectly observing what's going on in the T-bill market, for example, or, you know, long-term or Eurodollar futures or, you know, basis swap trades and things like that. You have to look at what the market is telling you, not what the Fed is doing.
Yeah, I think you said it on one of our interviews where you know, I asked you how you would determine if the system had been fixed, or maybe if the education level with the public or the financial media had gotten to the point where we can fix the system. And I think you said it's when no one knows the name of the Fed chair.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, just a simple example. Most people believe don't fight the Fed. But right. Yet you look at the bond market. The bond market's been fighting the Fed for a long time. I mean, Alan Greenspan's conundrum was 2005. So the bond market knows that the Fed, what the Fed really is. The Fed is nothing more than an emperor with no clothes. And it's not even an emperor. It's just a naked guy running around claiming to be an emperor. So yeah. The bond market knows don't fight the Fed is garbage. But yet the vast majority of the public thinks, you know, don't fight the Fed. The Fed is a central bank. The Fed is the most powerful entity ever conceived, right? And it's that disconnect that creates all this confusion, because you don't, I mean, the bond market is acting as if the Fed doesn't matter, because it doesn't. We don't know how to interpret it because we believe the Fed does. And so we have to run everything, all of our mainstream worldview through bank reserves and the Federal Reserve. And it just leads to utter chaos and confusion because the world doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, literally every single time they've done QE, interest rates have gone up.
Yes.
The exact, I mean, if you look at the, I did a video the other day using a clip from the Bank of England's YouTube video where they explained the intention of quantitative right. easing, and they said it's to bring down rates at the long end of the curve. So
it never has.
It's done the opposite. Even this right. last round when they went up to 120 billion, you know, you call it QE infinity. Rates are, I think at when they started that, when they announced that, the 10 low. Year. Was right about point, right about 50 basis points, yep. I think, something like that. And now, although it's come down significantly recently, it's still at, 120 or 130 basis points. So it's just bizarre, the complete opposite. And I don't want to take up too much of your time, but that's when I think of, you know, yield curve control. And I'm like, well, how maybe they can't do yield curve control if inflation got out of hand, because every single that basically QE has it is yield curve control to a certain degree. You know, I know it's not identical. No, because
you look at the first QE1, for example. You're exactly right. Yields started to rise as soon as QE1 was announced in December 2008. They went up. Yeah. They went up the entire time the Fed was buying U.S. Treasuries during QE1. So their bond buying had no effect on interest rates, because it's the market that controls.
Inverse effect.
And the market said, this bond buying, maybe it will work. Maybe QE will work and growth and inflation will be the result. But it didn't last very long. And that's the key point. The market says this in QE2, same thing. QE2 comes around, the yields start to rise again. But they only rose for a couple months. And the reason they only rose for a couple months was they gave Ben Bernanke the benefit of the doubt. Maybe this stuff will work. And after a couple months, it was clear it's not working. And then yields sink again. And it's the market that controls yields. And by the way, the central banks know this. If you read the studies that they publish, what they'll say is, well, we lower term premiums, or we might lower rates a little bit more than they already have been lowered. And when you think about it that way, how did they get low to begin with if it wasn't QE? It's the market saying things are so bad, growth and inflation, or the potential for both of those are coming down so far, it makes sense for yields to go down and down and down, which is entirely consistent with Milton Friedman's interest rate fallacy, which is always says low rates signal tight money, high rates loose money. If you see low rates persist, it tells you QE hasn't been money printing. There is no inflationary potential in the economy. It's exactly the opposite.
But not just the global economy.
Global, yes, the global system.
We've got to insert that in there.
That's the thing that he missed in the 1990s, Friedman did. Was that the system had already, we had a global system by then. And that's another complication on top of the mistaken worldview that runs everything through the central bank and Federal Reserve. We have a global system, a global monetary system. The banking system knows it. The monetary system knows what goes on, even if it doesn't hit the pages of Bloomberg or the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah. All right, buddy. I've kept you way too long here. I appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure, George. I love
it. Yeah. Yeah, man, I really learned a lot on that. I learn a lot on every, you know, every time I talk to you. But that time I really, really got a ton of value there. So from a personal level, thank you very, very much. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, the podcast of the meal and all the good stuff, where can they go?
It's a Eurodollar University's Making Sense. It's available on YouTube. It's available on, as you mentioned before, all the podcast channels, pretty much anywhere. And I publish I publish a lot of material myself, just articles and such, thoughts about reverse repo and T-bills at alhambrapartners.com.
Awesome. Jeff, appreciate it. Can't wait to do it again.
Okay, George.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you, you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, Luke Groman, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.